Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Toronto Blue Jays still stuck on magic number 3. The Seattle Mariners win last night against the Houston Astros. And the Toronto Blue Jays get blanked by the New York Yankees. Michael King once again befuddling the Toronto Blue Jays bats. The Jays lose 2-0 down at Rogers Center. I was down there. It was a fun game for 8 innings or so, if a little tense. The Michael King story was different than the last time the Blue Jays saw him, when he struck out 13 and walked 0 over 7 innings. Perhaps nibbling because it was the second time he was seeing the Jays in short order. Perhaps the Jays had a better game plan to get deeper into counts against him. But King's swing and miss stuff wasn't quite the same level, and his control wasn't quite as precise. He walked 5 batters over 6 innings. Only struck out five. But the Toronto Blue Jays did not muster a hit other than an Alejandro Kirk single while Michael King was in the game. A lot of traffic on the base paths, including a nice inning where Alejandro Kirk got that hit. Michael King walked consecutive batters. Vladimir Guerrero Jr. starts a plate appearance up 3-0 in the count and then takes 3 consecutive strikes. We talked a lot yesterday about Vlad's improved swing decisions of late. And, some of that is chasing a little less, and certainly chasing less before there are 2 strikes in a count. When you get to 2 strikes, though, you gotta swing at it. Now, look, to be completely honest, it was a pretty precision 2-seamer from Michael King that kind of did what it does sometimes. It looks like a ball until the last possible second, and it cuts back to the arm side there. Now, according to, the game day graphic, you can look at it, wasn't actually a strike, but either way, borderline, you tip your hat to Michael King on a well-executed pitch there. That is really the only time the Blue Jays threatened to put anything on the board. They managed just 3 hits and 6 walks overall. They grounded into a pair of double plays. They left 7 on base, but they only even had 2 plate appearances with runners in scoring position, or 3 plate appearances, rather, a walk and 2 outs. So not a lot going on the offensive side. Now, it was 0-0 until late, because after a 27-pitch first inning where Kevin Gausman didn't seem to have his location, didn't seem to have, he was just struggling to put guys away there early on, he settles in. He ends up generating 16 swing and miss on the day, including 9 on the splitter. So nice to see those kind of results back for the splitter. Nice to see the splitter back moving at its kind of season average rate. We talked a little bit about how the movement on that splitter had decreased over the last little while. That was back. The velocity was mostly solid. So yeah, after a 27-pitch first inning, Gausman really settled in. He goes 7 shutout innings. They only get 5 base runners. He only strikes out 5, which is an only for Gausman, but that should be enough for him to lock up the American League strikeout crown. Eric Swanson gives a clean 8th inning. And then in the top of the 9th, Jordan Romano comes in. And this continues to be a weird thing with Jordan Romano where, look, 3-year sample, he has been arguably the best closer in baseball. Probably, I don't think many people will put him number 1, but he's pretty firmly in the top 5, maybe even top 3. You could look at Devin Williams, Emmanuel Class A. There are guys, but you look at over a 3-year window, well, Jordan Romano's first in win probability added, which, measures situations like last night where, hey, you came into that game tied in the 9th. That's a very different situation to come into than, up 3 with the bottom of the order coming up or something like that. There continues to be a bit of an odd thing this year where when Romano comes into tie games, he is not particularly effective. This was, I think, his 7th loss of the season. And because he hasn't really blown any saves, almost all of those have come in tie games when he comes in. And his strikeout to walk ratio at this point in a save situation is 4.2. In a non-save situation, which includes tie scenarios, it's 1.3. So we see a big drop off in strikeouts. We see a big increase in walks. Why that is, it's probably mostly noise, but it was prevalent last night as Jordan Romano gives up a 2-run home run to Austin Wells. That would be the only offense for the ball game. Jays fall to 87-70. As of this morning, they're still in the second wild card spot. They are a game and a half up on Houston, 2 games up on Seattle. So Seattle won last night. They closed that gap by a game there, but the Jays still in pretty good shape. We know if they win three the rest of the week, they're in for sure. We know that if they win two, it's very likely they're in. However, each day that you don't win, it gets dicier and dicier, especially when you look tonight and Gerrit Cole is the opposing pitcher likely headed for a Cy Young, and he has given you a lot of trouble three different times this year. You'll see him a fourth time tonight, and you pretty badly need to get back on the winning ledger. Ben Nicholson-Smith, MLB editor at sportsnet.ca, joins us now. Ben, good morning. How are you, buddy?
Doing well. Hey, Blake, how's it going?
I'm well. That was an interesting game to be in seats for. There's not much more deflating on the fan side than a closer blowing the game. And I know, look, I listened to a bit of, you know, Blair and Barker Jay's talk post game. I know anytime a closer does anything remotely bad, it makes for the best call-in shows, because, you know, it's difficult to have the long view when it comes to guys in high leverage roles. What do you make of the fact that Jordan Romano has had blips here in consecutive games, and over his last since September 4th, 6 earned runs over 10 innings, 6 walks in those 10 innings as well. As much as there's a huge sample on Jordan Romano that says he's very, very good, he has not had the best last couple of weeks here.
Yeah, it's been tough, especially when you throw in the fact that he's dealing with that crack in the fingernail. And I asked John Schneider about this before yesterday's game, trying to get a sense of how Romano is doing physically. And the manager said, he's fine, he's good to go, not an issue. So maybe that's the case. Maybe that had nothing to do with the fact that the Yankees were able to come back, or not come back. They were able to score a couple and win that game. But at the same time, I just can't help but think this would be a great week to get Jordan Romano some rest if you can. And of course, first things first, like, you got to win the games. And so I'm not sitting here second guessing that decision to use him, because if they win that game, all of a sudden, you know, Wednesday could be a clinching day for the Blue Jays, and you're thrilled about that. So I understand why you use him, but I can't help but think you don't want to run into a situation where you have to use this guy, you know, again tonight, and then two more times against the Rays, and he goes into the wild card series kind of having been used a lot while also dealing with that crack that he dealt with on the weekend in St. Petersburg.
So yeah, the crack in the nail, look, I've never cracked a nail like that, and I also don't throw a slider. So I'm presuming, given that we thought it gave him issues, it's probably on his middle finger or thumb, maybe on his pointer finger. But those are the ones generally involved in the slider there. So look, we've seen the slider get less break. It got less break yesterday. Now, whether we attribute that to the nail, whether we attribute that to the prior back issues he had, where, Ben, since he came back off the IL, he is getting a little less extension down the mound. And that's usually something that's a big deal for Jordan Romano. You know, it helps a 96, 97 mile an hour fastball play up because he's coming so far down the mound. Look, he's not going to get the next 5 days off, I don't think. The Jays have some urgency here, and he might not want to go 5 days without work. But what do you, if he does get into a game, what are you looking for? You know, is it the walks? Is it that extension down the mound? Is it the break on the slider?
You know, yeah, and of course, it would definitely, you know, if you're the Jays, you want him in there at some point. If you're Jordan Romano, I'm sure you want to get a bounce back outing or two in there and just help his team win. So no question about that. He'll be in there at some point. And then as for what to look for, I just think it's throwing strikes, really, because when it comes to releasing the baseball, you know, with any sort of disruption to the nail or finger, you know, what's that feel going to look like? Is that going to allow him to throw strikes the way he normally would? So to me, I would just keep it as simple as, is he able to get ahead of hitters 0-2, 1-2? And then if he can, then he'll definitely be able to put them away, because he's got great stuff. He's been one, as you said, such a good closer in recent years. So I don't think the concern level is high. I don't think it's like off the charts concerning, but I do think there's a little bit of concern, because everything at this point in the season is just magnified. Like, if this was March the 12th, we wouldn't care at all. We might not even talk about it, but we should talk about it because we are at a point in the season where those little things become a lot bigger.
So last year in the wild card series, and this didn't go particularly well, but it's maybe not entirely Romano to blame here. But if we look back to the one wild card game that Jordan Romano appeared in, Anthony Bass came in to face 3-4-5 in the eighth inning, and he put all those guys on base, one run scored. Jordan Romano got brought in with nobody out in the eighth inning because it was just such a big spot. Runners on base, again, a close game that you couldn't really risk the Mariners coming back all the way on you, and it didn't go particularly well. But I'm curious, when you look at the way the Jays bullpen shapes up right now, the additional weapons that John Schneider has versus last year, where, you know, you had to use an Anthony Bass in a big spot, or you gave Kevin Gausman maybe a little bit too early of a hook, and then, you know, that forced you to go a little deeper into your bullpen. When you look at Romano's usage for the playoffs, I guess this is a double barrel question, in that I would like your opinion and how you think John Schneider would see it. Are we kind of removing the traditional closer definition/usage for the playoffs, where Jordan Romano will just, you know, can be used in whatever situation seems like the best one, even if it means, say, a Jordan Hicks ends up closing out a game?
Yeah, really interesting question. I think, so as far as how the Blue Jays will operate, my guess is that they will continue to use Jordan Romano much in the same way that they have all season. I think that they will use him in tie games, as we saw last night. I think we'll see him used, obviously, in safe situations. I don't think that we see him deployed in the seventh inning. I think you could use Jordan Hicks in that situation, Chad Green, Jimmy Garcia. They got a lot of guys that they like, and rightfully so. It's a really, really good bullpen. So I think we see Romano used in a more traditional way, at least out of the gate. You know, injuries can shift things as the playoffs unfold, if the Blue Jays are good and lucky enough to continue playing in October. And then as for how I would do it, I would also do it that way. I would not start using Jordan Romano in the sixth inning. I'm sure he can do it. And look, if they're down one run, or if the base is loaded, game three of the wild card series, you could think about it. You could make a strong case that base is loaded, sixth inning, wild card series, game three, you should do it. But I'm probably going to Chad Green in that situation. And you could maybe that's like the wrong way to look at it, but I don't think I would start using Romano in the sixth inning in that kind of leverage spot.
Yeah, I mean, in the sixth inning, you know, let's say it's a nobody on base or a lighter on base situation. Well, yeah, that part of the order is going to come up again, right? Like that is something, you know, seventh inning, you can maybe get there, where if 2-3-4 in the order are up and it's a particularly difficult 2-3-4 that Romano's had success against or profiles well against, well, that part of the order may not come up again if you execute there. So I could get it there. But yeah, sixth is a little early. And like you said, Jordan Hicks was kind of acquired to be the Jordan Romano you can use in an earlier spot. And of course, if everything goes well this week, you know, it'd be all hands on deck for those three wildcard games. Ben, you had a terrific piece at sportsnet.ca yesterday setting this week up. It was called Strategic Subplots to Watch as Blue Jays Push for Playoffs in Final Week. There are a couple things in there I want to pick at here and kind of blow out, because yeah, yesterday they lost. It's a 2-0 loss. It really does feel like, going into the specifics of that game though, we did it last week with the Michael King and Garrett Cole starts. I don't know that a ton of the context there has changed. So let's take a look at some of the subplots that you pointed out for this week ahead. Obviously the biggest one is, well, you got to clinch a spot. Three gets you in for sure. Two probably gets you in, but you'd like to take care of that sooner than later. But the first bullet point you had in that piece, the first subplot was, well, what does Brandon Belt look like? How do you know he's ready to go? And you know, obviously he's back physically and he's going to DH as much as they see fit this week. But Ben, what are you looking for to let you know that Brandon Belt is feeling good at the plate, is, you know, ready to start every day in a wild card series where you're only going to face righties?
I think it's the hard contact. I mean, we know, and even we saw last night, his first game back, he's able to draw a walk. And that's not a surprise to anyone. He's got a great idea of the strike zone. So that seems to be there. But I think if you're the Jays, you want to see some hard contact. You want to see some authoritative swings where the ball is bouncing up against the wall, or ideally clearing the wall, and he's giving you some of that power. I think Brandon Belt, when you look at not only this final stretch of the regular season where they're facing right-handed pitching, but of course in the playoffs, as we've talked about, Twins, Rays, these are very right-handed heavy teams at this point. So that really creates opportunity for Brandon Belt. And it really means that he is an important player for at least the first six innings of those games to be able to go in there and give the Blue Jays a really good at-bat in games that we expect will probably be really close.
So Brandon Belt hit sixth yesterday. They tried to split up the lefties a little bit. Not completely optimized, you know, lefty spread, but also George Springer, Bo Bichette, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. are probably going to hit 1-2-3. Maybe not universally, but that seems to be where they're locked in there. So they went Biggio at 4, Belt at 6, Varsho 7, Kiermaier 9. I think we probably would anticipate, if things are well with Brandon Belt, him and Biggio would maybe swap spots there. But with that exception, do you think yesterday was probably what the wild card game one lineup would look like, assuming everyone gets there healthy?
I think it's pretty close. And there's still time for all of that to change because, you know, in these wild card series, you're going to some extent with who's healthy, who's hot. I think that the next week can inform that. But I think that what we saw yesterday was pretty close to what you're going to see as far as a wild card lineup. You do see some left-right balance there. You see some good defense there. You know, offensively, some of these guys have had their struggles this year. There's no question about that. I'm sure the Jays, you know, continue to be a little, they love what Matt Chapman brings on defense, but he certainly hasn't brought a lot offensively in the last little while.
The last guys, 5 months.
Well, yeah, like the last long while, yeah. The last season, really. And then you get to Alejandro Kirk on the other hand, and Kirk, you know, especially in the second half of the season, he's been tremendous offensively. Like, then I think too, like, we all know he's not a good base runner, but Alejandro Kirk, you know, he really does a good job of getting on base, stealing those strikes. Like, he's been a really good player for this team. So, you know, I to answer your question, I think that is pretty close to what we would see as a wild card lineup.
Little Alejandro Kirk stat for you via Chris Black. So I'd imagine this is coming up on Blue Jay Central later today. But currently, Alejandro Kirk has the worst base running value metric in Blue Jays franchise history based on how Fangraphs calculates that. It is not particularly close, and that's behind names like Kendrys Morales, Benji Molina, and Frank Thomas.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes sense. Like, I remember I covered Kendrys Morales here, and I, you know, he wasn't a good base runner by any stretch, but I think Kirk is a worse base runner. So, you know, he's not, like, we all know it. Like, you see Giancarlo Stanton or Miguel Cabrera.
Oh, my goodness. That's Stanton go to home yesterday.
Yeah, I know. I mean, so other teams are impacted by this too at times. And those guys were obviously Hall of Fame sluggers. That's not what Alejandro Kirk is. But I think too, like, we can get a little bit, and I'm probably guilty of this too, but I think with Kirk, we can get a little bit guilty of talking about the stuff he doesn't do. And no, like, he hasn't hit for power. We know that. He hasn't been able to run fast. It's not going to change anytime soon. But he does a lot of things really well. Like, he's a pretty good defensive catcher with a 340 on base who posts every day.
Yes. And I mean, man, the playing time lately, and I like that you've adopted Arden's term for playing every day as well. We're getting the rugby terminology into baseball now with posting every day. Yeah, and Kirk has, look, a 775 OPS in the second half here. It's a little over 800 the last month or so. He's been better, and he's in there pretty much every day, which is huge given Danny Jansen's injury. So that leads to a question, though. The base running element of that, Ben, is, you know, if we look ahead to not even necessarily a wild card roster because the Jays still have to get there, but what these next five games look like, Tyler Heineman is there, and you probably don't want Tyler Heineman starting one of these games until you clinch if you can avoid it. You probably don't want Tyler Heineman coming up to bat in a big spot, even though he does have, you know, some of the good approach stuff that the Jays look for. There are scenarios, though, where you should be aggressive pinch running for Alejandro Kirk. I wouldn't argue any of those came up yesterday. But when you look at scenarios like that, and I think Kirk is front of mind, but he's not the only one. Brandon Belt is back now, another guy who you would maybe pinch run for. Do you think we see a little more Cam Eden this week?
I think the Jays should use him for sure. And, you know, at first you just got to win the games. Like, you can't force it. I agree. Last night, like, I wondered about it. There was a situation late in the game where Kirk lined out to left, but if he had got on base, mm-hmm. like, you could have thought about putting Eden in with Varsho ahead of him and Kiermaier coming up. So as it turned out, there just wasn't an opportunity for Cam Eden. So no, like, you don't force it, but I do think that getting Cam Eden in, if the Jays are up six or down six today, like, do it, have him hit once, Have him pinch run, have him attempt a couple steals, just really get him in there. And then if they get to the point that, let's say it's Saturday and they've clinched, start Cam Eaton at least one of those games just to get his familiarity improved at the major league level. And I think there is a real chance, we'll see how the Jays play this out, but I think there's a real chance that he is on a playoff roster. And in my opinion, he should be. Like, he should be one of the 26 players that they take with them to Minneapolis or St. Petersburg, because he has a clear role. Remember, in the playoffs, Kirk will start every single game. There's mm-hmm. not going to be a single Tyler Heineman start if the Jays can help it. And Kirk is the slowest base runner. And he gets on base a lot. So if you're down one, Kirk's on base, you got to go to someone, and Cam Eaton is as good as it gets. So I think there is a very, very clear path to using him in the most important games of your season. And that means you got to get him ready in the course of the next five.
And for anyone who's missed it and is maybe wondering why we're giving airtime to Cam Eaton, obviously, if you've been listening to the show, you know the numbers at this point, but in case you've missed it at some point, he went 53 for 57 stealing bases at AAA this year. I went back and looked at his college seasons as well as some of the summer circuit ball that he's played. And for all the games we have numbers for, he is career 173 for 200. Now, that's harder in the major leagues. I'm sure pitchers have better pickoff moves, catchers are better, but that is a remarkable efficiency mark. And everything we hear from the scout types, from people with the Bison, I had Casey Kendall on yesterday, the Bison's manager, and he said, like, Cam Eaton has like the greenest of lights, because not only is it, you know, not only is he fast, and that helps him be a plus defender in the outfield as well, but his reads on pitchers and his timing going are really, really good. We saw that on the weekend as well when he scored from third on a wild pitch after advancing second to third on an infield ground out. So some value there. I guess, Ben, the question that flows from that, though, is if he's on your 26-man roster, is that at the expense of a 13th pitcher? Is that at the expense of, say, a Santiago Espinal? Because right now the Jays have 14 position players on their roster. Traditionally, one of those guys would be coming off because you shrink from 28 to 26, but you could see it in a wild card series where it's only three games where maybe you carry 14. Who do you think, or which side of the ledger do you think Cam Eaton inclusion would come at the expense of?
So I think it's a really interesting debate, and you obviously have to have it because someone isn't going to be going if Cam Eaton is. So, me and Shai were debating this yesterday a little bit, and I can see a case for just not, and this is kind of where I lean. Okay. So I'll start with where I lean is just not rostering Santiago Espinal. Mm-hmm. And that would mean you go into the wildcard series without having a backup shortstop on your team. Like, that's not traditionally how teams do it.
Whatever.
Backup shortstops exist and that's where I land, right? Is I kind of agree with you, Blake. Like, whatever. Like, Bo Bichette's going to play all nine innings. If it goes extras, it's not like you're taking Bo Bichette out. Like, he's staying in.
And if he's hurt, you're in big trouble anyway, right? Like,
exactly. And look, if he's hurt, you can have Matt Chapman play short. Or more realistically, you'd probably actually have Kevin Biggio play short for a couple innings.
He's done it now.
And the way he's done it now, the way he's playing defensively is the best defensive baseball of his career. It's what John Schneider said. It's what John Schneider has seen. We know that Biggio would embrace the challenge. So if you have to play Kevin Biggio for, you know, something bad happens, Bo Bichette pulls a quad, Kevin Biggio's in there for six innings, then you make a roster move between games, and none of that's ideal because Bo Bichette in that scenario isn't available anyway. But I think that, I think you could figure it out. I think you could. So the other option would be you go a little bit shorter on the pitching staff. And realistically, okay, you're pitching with an off day on either side, you have to cover three games, probably 27 innings in the course of 5 days with an off day on either side. You're fine pitching wise. Like, you don't need all the guys you're going to roster, but they're essentially security blankets. And I do like the idea of having a couple security blankets in your bullpen, because remember too, there's no ghost runner on second base if a postseason game goes extra innings. So you don't want to be in a situation where it's the 11th inning and okay, it's not like regular season where the 11th inning, it's going to be over soon. Like, you might go to the 15th. And so in that case, to me, you need to have Yusei Kikuchi or Bowden Francis on the wildcard roster, even though they're obviously not going to start games. So I think you need to have some pitching depth We all know the guys in the late inning spots who are going to be on this roster for the Jays. So that's where I lean to probably you just go a little bit shorter on the position player side and find a way to get Eden on there.
And so just to round out the Santiago Espinal side of that, if you are looking for a potential scenario where Espinal could have a role in a postseason series, well, they don't, they're, we don't know their opponent yet, but we know neither opponent starts a left-handed pitcher in their rotation. So, and then if you're looking at pinch hit scenarios against the lefty, I think probably, well, certainly Davis Schneider and probably Whit Merrifield are ahead of him on the pinch hit depth chart as well.
Exactly.
And, you know, his defense hasn't been as great this year. We actually saw Cam Eden pinch run for him. So that tells you about the running value there. So it's hard to see a scenario where he factors into a wild card game unless Bo Bichette gets hurt. So you mentioned the pitching side here, Ben, and another one of the subplots you mentioned. And look, there's a ton of value in, for a lot of reasons, in getting the work done early here. And they can now clinch as early as tomorrow instead of today because of the loss yesterday. The magic number to clinch is three still. When it comes to lining up your rotation, look, Sunday's game is the big one where you don't have to use Kevin Gausman if you are clinched by then. That's huge. You wrote about lining up your rotation. Now, Barrios is going to start tonight. Bassett is going to start tomorrow. Are you comfortable that that's the Gausman, Barrios, Bassett is how it lines up for the wildcard series? Is that how you want it anyway? And you're thinking, when you talk about lining up your pitchers more, you're thinking about making sure those guys have the certainty of when they're pitching and, you know, when to get the side sessions and things like that? Or are you thinking juggle here, tweak here?
To me, I wouldn't juggle. I wouldn't tweak it. I would just keep it exactly as it is. And everyone in that room would know that if you need Kevin Gausman on the Sunday, he's going to be used on the Sunday. At that point, it goes Barrios, Bassett, Kikuchi, and you roll from there. In obviously, the plan A is to not have to use Gausman. I think that's still likely. And then you go Gausman, Barrios, Bassett. And to me, it is one, they're all good pitchers, and Bassett and Barrios are not so different as far as the overall quality of work that they offer. They obviously get there in different ways, but the overall quality of work that they offer is comparable. You're very comfortable with each. You're probably not expecting either to give you seven innings, but certainly both are strong candidates for 5 to 6 innings, a couple times through the order, and pitch really effectively in that scenario. And I just don't want to get in these guys' heads of like, oh, if this, then that. Just give them the message that we trust you. These are the two possible scenarios. We're going to get as much clarity as we can based on our record, and we can't wait to give you guys the ball. Like, that's the message I would want to go with.
You'd mentioned as well potentially having Bowden Francis in the bullpen. I think a couple people were caught off guard yesterday when, in addition to Belt being activated and Horwitz being optioned down, Jay Jackson returned and Nate Pearson was sent down. Bowden Francis still isn't at his, even though the AAA season is done, you know, he's still not at his 15 days to get recalled, and no one's hit the IL. Would you anticipate when that, I think it's the 30th, whichever day that ends up being, Friday or Saturday, I think, I'm not good at calendars this week, Ben. But would you anticipate Bowden Francis back in this bullpen once his clock's up?
I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised at all if he is back. But at the same time, I could see them just waiting it out as well. Because, you know, so on the Sunday, there obviously could be an opportunity to cover some innings. Francis would be a great candidate to cover some innings if the Blue Jays need that. At the same time, they really like what he's done. You might not want to burn him for 50 or 60 pitches on that Sunday. You might actually rather he's sort of available for you going into that wild card series. So maybe you do more of a bullpen game. I mean, there are different ways that they could approach it. I think there are certainly scenarios where Francis is back and active by this weekend, but I don't think that there's a need to do that either. And I don't think whether he's active or not would necessarily have any bearing on whether he would be selected to the 26-man wildcard roster that has to be sent into the commissioner's office by next Tuesday. So I think it could go a few different ways at this point.
Wait, so they could, so they, it's, theoretically, if they had a noon game in wildcard game one, they don't have to submit the roster till that morning?
Yeah. Yeah. It's due Tuesday.
That is not great for our purposes on this show at 10 a.m. on Tuesday, but I guess, who knows, maybe we get the news live. I don't know what I'm going to talk about Monday. Otherwise, when you guys are all, traveling. Ben, last one for you before I let you go here. Twins and Rays, one of those teams, if the Jays make the playoffs here, are going to host the Jays. Both of those teams are pretty banged up. The Jays have to clinch still. They have to do the work. But after that, probably the biggest priority is making sure you get to the wildcard series as healthy as you possibly can with Danny Jansen, your only real piece on the IL. No disrespect to Adam Simber. Who is the player that the Jays could least afford to head the Royce Lewis, Randy Arozarena route right now?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's sort of scary when you think about how you can get to this point in the season. And, you know, you mentioned Arozarena, like the Rays, all this uncertainty around Arozarena. Seems like Yandy Diaz is more day to day. Brandon Lau's out. I mean, it's like you can really run into a lot of issues. So for the Jays, we touched on this earlier, but to me, it's Kirk. It's like if anything were to happen to Kirk, then you're like, and no disrespect to Tyler Heineman, he's been a very effective complementary backup catcher to this team. But like, I mean, you do not want to be starting Tyler Heineman every single day. That would be a huge increase in workload. He's not nearly the hitter that Alejandro Kirk is. You're not going to expect him to get on base nearly as much as Kirk does, or to be able to make contact in the same way that Kirk can. So yeah, I think it's, that is probably the position with Danny Jansen, you know, I think at least a few weeks away from even being a real consideration. I think Kirk is the guy that you could least afford to lose.
Yeah, I read good things about this Jamie Ritchie guy, though, in terms of...
read some great things about this Jamie Ritchie guy, yes.
All right, Ben Nicholson-Smith, thanks so much for taking the time out, man. We will certainly bug you again next week, hopefully from Minnesota or Tampa, and not wrapping up the season after locker cleanout. Have a good one, buddy.
You know, the silver lining is if we are talking from Toronto, then it means we'll have a lot to talk about because something will have gone very, very wrong.
Yeah, look, we'll have a lot to talk about if they're in the wild card too. Let's yeah, lean toward that, Ben.
Yeah, sounds good. All right, thanks.
Ben Nicholson-Smith, Sportsnet and Sportsnet.ca. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to look at the other series that is very, very relevant to the Blue Jays' chances of clinching a playoff spot right now. The Seattle Mariners beat the Houston Astros last night. John Morosi was down there. It is the MLB Network feature showcase game again tonight. So let's take a break. Let's talk to John Morosi about the other side of this wild card race as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Diving deep into Leafs, Raptors, Jays, and NFL. The JD Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Toronto Blue Jays lose last night 2-0 to the New York Yankees. They will try to solve Gerrit Cole once again tonight. They will also continue to keep an eye on the out-of-town scoreboard because their magic number is 3. Not only could they get into the playoffs by winning 3 the rest of the way, but hey, if the Seattle Mariners do you a favor and bow out a little earlier, maybe you're celebrating as soon as tomorrow. John Morosi has been down around that Seattle Mariners Houston Astros series of MLB Network. It's the MLB Network showcase game tonight. He joins us now. John, good morning.
Good morning, Blake. I do believe this, that we can report this with confidence that at some point in time tonight, there will be a team that moves to 73 losses, which will help the Jays. So really, as much as the Mariners are nominally the one team that is out of the playoff spot, they are tied in the loss column with the Astros. And as we know, based on the math at this time of year, it's always the loss column that we talk about. So no matter what, really, I guess that the Jays fans can somewhat take a night off of their scoreboard watching, because either way, they're going to be fine based on the result of this game. They just have to find a way to face Gerrit Cole and get some hits tonight. That should be the main focus of the Blue Jays fans.
You are watching this Mariners Astros series very closely. Obviously, it's the network showcase game tonight. The Mariners just went almost a week, not without a win, but without a lead until last night's game. That's a big one for them for a lot of reasons. Why do you think, John, these three AL West teams have seemed down the stretch here so prone to just extend? Like, we just saw the Astros lose, I think, 6 of 7 to the Royals and get swept last weekend. The Mariners and Rangers have obviously both had really poor stretches. What do you make of this Mariners team and kind of getting cold at the wrong time here?
I think you're right on about the Mariners getting a little bit cold, and it's been a pretty inconsistent division when you talk about those three teams. And it's a great point, Blake, about how they've each had stretches where they look like World Series contenders and then stretches where they don't even look like a playoff team. That's what it's been. And I really think that the next few days will probably be determined by who can just find a way to get hot and to have that good run of form link up to the end of the season. Because I think two injuries have played a role in it. You look at the Rangers, and Seager has had a couple different times on the injured list. He was just hit by a pitch last night. That's a really concerning thing for Texas because he's been their most valuable player this season. Certainly there's been even some buzz about if he's played enough games and done enough to potentially usurp Shohei as the number one MVP pick in the American League. I would tend to doubt that, but he still had an amazing year. And I think the pitching side of things too on for Texas, I mean, the number of innings that have been missed by guys like Scherzer and DeGrom and Eovaldi, it's really remarkable that they are where they are right now. But then they bring in someone like the young Evan Carter, and he's had a really, really strong debut here with Texas and been able to play on an everyday basis for a contending club. So I think it's just been injuries, inconsistencies, but still a lot of talent. And I think all three teams are dangerous. All three teams, I think, would pose a lot of challenges in the postseason. And I think, Blake, that the larger point that I want to make here is that there were people that, certainly when the playoffs expanded, there was some concern about watering down the playoff field or an unworthy team getting in. Well, in fact, it's the opposite right now. A worthy team is not going to make it because really they're all good ball clubs. And certainly I put the Jays in that same conversation. They all have their flaws, but they're all certainly playoff teams in terms of the way they play on the field. So it's been a close race, and I cannot wait for the game tonight. It's gonna feel like, for us in our showcase game, Blake, it's going to feel like the deciding game in a playoff series. It obviously is not the final game of the regular season, but certainly whichever team wins tonight is going to be propelled into the final weekend with a sense of controlling their own destiny, and the other team is going to be in a state of desperation.
It's going to be a fun one, and it's Bryce Miller against Framber Valdez on the hill. Last night it was George Kirby who had such a good start for Seattle, but the player who really stood out to me in that one, and I was watching it after the Blue Jays game, John, and I know this is someone you're fond of, is Matt Brash. So we look back to the trade deadline, and the Mariners were less in a playoff spot. They traded away their closer in Paul Sewald, and some of that was about, yeah, getting Josh Rojas and Dominic Canzone, who can come in and fill a small role here. Some of it was about, well, you have Andres Munoz ready to go in the closer spot. But Matt Brash has also appeared in more games than anyone in baseball, any reliever in baseball this year. 13.7 strikeouts per nine, sub-3 ERA. How huge has Brash been to this Mariners team, especially in the second half here, where they've been able to, you know, until the last week or so, string together a second half push despite selling their closer at the deadline?
I think, Blake, that he's joined the hip among the greats to emerge from Kingston, Ontario. We could certainly say that. I would say with the way that Matt Brash has pitched, I mean, he's done an amazing job. And I really go back to the beginning of the year. I mentioned, of course, he pitched for Team Canada at the World Baseball Classic. There was this idea that perhaps the Mariners were going to have him stretch out as a starting pitcher. And he said, no thanks, I want to pitch for my country in the World Baseball Classic instead. That's more important to me. So good on him for making that choice. And it all worked out in the end because he is now fulfilling a role as a multi-inning reliever in just dynamic performance, Blake, from Matt Brash all season long. So I think it's worked out well for Matt, for Baseball Canada, for the Mariners at the end of the day. I think for me, you look at his appearances, leads the majors in terms of appearances. I think he's two away now from the franchise record. He is such a great athlete. You look at him pitch and his ability to shape the ball and to recover day to day. This is a superior athlete. I think what Matt Brash brings, beloved by his manager and his teammates, they just want to get him the ball. I mean, really, now we'll see tonight. They hope he's available tonight. But it's almost as though the Mariners feel as though the game is a race to get the ball to Matt Brash. They've got Munoz closing, but Brash is the guy that they want to be in to shut down the rallies in the seventh and or the eighth inning. And his ability to go six outs last night just rescued the game, because even though it ended up looking like a comfortable win on paper, there were some nervy moments. And I think Matt Brash quieted things down really well. Elite two-seamer. It's basically like a 101-mile-an-hour sinker, basically, and cutter that he can throw. It's just, it's unfair. No one else can really, I think it's a unique pitch in the game right now, what he's able to do. So, tremendous athlete, great, the pride of Kingston, Ontario, and someone who I think is going to be around this sport and the Mariner bullpen, hopefully, for a very, very long time.
I spent 4 years in Kingston, so I will take Matt Brash as one of my own as well. I just keep,
there you go.
Keep
so,
changing.
So, I mean, We got to go like the Mount Rushmore of Kingston, right? So yeah. It's Gilmore's hometown too, yeah. Right? So the hip, yeah. So I mean, it's a pretty good group there. Matt Brash joins the group.
Yeah, it's I think Dan Aykroyd's from there as well. If we want to sprinkle in an actor and not just go
love
sports,
it.
So we're set there. So it's Bryce Miller against Framber Valdez tonight. Valdez ostensibly Houston's number one. He was one of the very best pitchers in baseball over the first half of the season, had this really, really tough July, and he's been more solid since, but not quite the same level. What are you looking for from Valdez down the stretch here and maybe heading into a wild card series? What are the Astros looking to get back to with Framber Valdez?
Well, I think with him, Blake, it's always been at times some concerns with command. I mean, he will in some moments as good as he'll go, and then maybe there's one adverse pitch or outcome, and things can sometimes tend to unravel. I mean, the ability and the stuff has never been in question with him. I think it's just been maybe the challenge of avoiding the one bad inning or the one bad moment and handling adversity. He's gotten a lot better at that in the last couple of years in comparison to what he was when he was coming up through the minor leagues. I mean, he had to battle through that, the ability to handle adversity and to keep his command and composure. He worked on that a lot coming through the minor leagues, and I think his performance at the major league level has really been emblematic of all that he's been able to achieve in doing that. And I think that tonight, if I'm the Mariners, I look at ways to try to disrupt his rhythm. And that involves having base runners. It involves, I think, specifically having Julio Rodriguez on base. And whether it's trying a stolen base, whether it's just having some action on the base path, making the defense make a play, and making Framber throw strikes. I mean, I think that's going to be the key thing tonight, because you're right. I mean, from the beginning of the year to now, he's been their ace. Certainly they got Verlander back, and Verlander had an ace's performance on Monday. But Framber's been their best starter since the beginning of the year. And I do think tonight is one of those games where it's remarkable, Blake, how the game will find you and often sets the stage for what the best story is, what the most important story is to bring the season all to a conclusion. And here they are in the biggest game of the year, and they've got the guy who's been their ace this season against a talented rookie right-hander in Bryce Miller. I mean, I think you could easily make a case that Miller is a perfect guy for the Mariners to have on the mound, but you look at it and you say one guy's been in the Cy Young conversation all year long, and Framber, who's got World Series experience and some incredible career achievements. I mean, Houston has to feel good. They've got their bullpen rested and ready to go after not having a lead last night. So I think that the mechanics of this day set up very well for Houston to win it, but that is why they play the games.
That is why they play the games, and at times it's looked like the other team in that American League West, Texas, is out of it as well. So we're still waiting for those three teams to shake out in the AL West. We're waiting for those three teams and the Blue Jays to shake out in the wild card race. Meanwhile, Minnesota and Tampa Bay, there are still like small percentage chances it doesn't end up this way, but mostly Minnesota and Tampa are just sitting back waiting to find out which of these teams they host. When you look at the Twins, obviously the top end of the the rotation speaks for itself. But they're entering this final week here and maybe the wild card series where we don't know, is Joey Gallo going to be back? We don't know what, like Royce Lewis, maybe, maybe not. Carlos Correa, probably, but not entirely. Byron Buxton was on a rehab assignment. Now he's back in Minnesota working out while the team hits the road. Those are four really big question marks. I know you're not around the Twins right now, but what is your read on just where they are health-wise and threat-wise heading into this wild card round?
Well, it's a race to get healthy for them. I mean, there's no question about that. And if all of those questions are answered in the affirmative and Correa comes back, and I think the report there was pretty encouraging. We know how much Correa loves the postseason, and we know how much it stung for him to not be part of it last year and watch his former mates in Houston there in the World Series and eventually winning it. So I think he is as motivated as anybody, and he's been dealing with his plantar fasciitis, and it sounds like there was a tear of it, which actually, and again, I'm not a doctor, my wife is, but I'm not, but it's as what I've always been told about the plantar fasciitis is that when there is a tear, it helps actually sometimes in the healing process. So Correa may actually be better than he's been in a long time by the time the playoffs get going next week. And Royce Lewis, my goodness, one of the best players in the game in the second half. And for him to hopefully come back, he's had a hamstring issue. There's confidence there that it's not going to be a super long-term thing. So I think that they would expect to have both Correa and Lewis in the lineup next week. Their pitching is really good. Lopez, Gray are two guys who are in the Cy Young conversation. They just added Chris Paddock to the bullpen. Max Kepler's had a really good second half. I think he's showing people that he can still be one of the really talented young players in the game. And now he's more of a veteran, but I think I'm a big Max Kepler guy. I think he's still got a tremendous amount of talent. So the Twins, for me, are a dangerous team. They've been able to set up their rotation. They're young, they're athletic. All of the notions of what they've failed to do in the playoffs in the past are completely irrelevant, in my opinion. It's all ancient history now. I don't think anybody there is really caring about, you know, what happened in Game 2 of the American League Division Series back in 2004. They were all basically in kindergarten then. So I just think that it's not about that at all. It's about, can they handle the teams that are coming in? And I really believe that with, especially with Lopez and Gray, and they've got a really talented closer in Duran. I think they've got a good playoff team that teams would overlook at their own peril.
Yeah, and look, we know that home runs carry a lot of weight in the playoffs as well, and that's a team where almost everyone, potentially everyone they have in their starting lineup in Game 1 has double-digit home runs. So a lot of fun there, a lot of fun down in Seattle tonight. John, once the Jays game's over, we'll all be tuning in to Mariners-Astros on MLB Network. Thanks for taking the time out this morning. Have a blast this last week.
Sounds great, Blake. I look forward to it. I always enjoy as well, even when we're on the air, when you're watching, like I'll get a text from you. It's awesome. I appreciate the support and then that you're watching as well. So enjoy it tonight. I love this time of year. In some ways, Blake, it's even better than the playoffs because you've got all these different games mattering all during the course of the day. So it's going to be a lot of fun tonight. I feel very, very blessed to be here.
Thanks so much, John. Have a good one.
You as well. Take care. Thanks so much.
John Morosi, MLB Network. That Astros-Mariners series continues tonight on MLB Network. Obviously, the Jays still in action tonight as well. And in fact, the Jays might be on MLB Network tomorrow night. It's not one of their showcase games, but they have the option to flex certain games into those. And right now it's listed as Jays versus Yankees or Cubs versus Braves. Both of those games with potentially large wild card implications because the Cubs are kind of right there. If you haven't been keeping up on the National League side, it's just as tight as the American League side. Arizona is a game up on Chicago. Chicago's got the last wild card spot. Miami's only half a game back. Cincinnati technically still not eliminated, a game and a half back there. So a lot of fun going down on the NL side as well. To refresh you, the Jays magic number is 3. It will, even if they do nothing tonight, well, they can't do nothing, they will lose. It would shrink to 2 because one of Seattle and Houston have to lose in this one. And to tee up the week for you, 3 wins and the Jays are for sure in. 2 wins almost definitely gets them there, but not with 1,000% certainty. So after the Jays are done with New York, they will, of course, host Tampa Bay. Houston finishes off this series at Seattle tonight, and then they play Arizona for three on the weekend. Arizona still with a lot to play for, so that could be a huge series as well. And then Seattle wraps up against Houston tonight. Texas wraps up against the Angels tonight, and then those two teams see each other for four over the final weekend. So there is going to be a lot of scoreboard watching. If you're a Toronto Blue Jays fan, certainly if you are the Tampa Bay Rays and the Minnesota Twins trying to figure out how this all goes down. If the Blue Jays had a preference between wildcard two and wildcard three, maybe you'd be looking even more closely. But I think we've well established at this point, given the injury question marks and pitching quality of the Twins and the injury question marks and overall quality of the Rays, your preference probably comes down to how afraid of the Trop are you, or not afraid of the Trop are you. Could set up also a weird series this weekend with the Jays and Rays not having a ton to play for and not wanting to show each other much ahead of a potential series against each other. We already know the Jays aren't going to get Glasnow, or it doesn't sound like Zach Eflin, because the Rays have an off day tomorrow and they can manage around that. So the Jays would potentially see the back three in the rotation. I think that's probably how Tampa wants it. Let's take a break. Let's continue. Let's get back to talking about this Toronto Blue Jays team. We'll talk about last night a little bit. Take a longer look at Jordan Romano, Vladimir Guerrero Jr., and Brandon Belt's return with Joe Siddall as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Your daily dose of everything NFL. It's the Fan Checkdown with Matt Marchese and Donovan Bennett. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays lose 2-0 last night. It's 0-0 into the ninth. Now, look, if you put a zero up on the board, I think always more blame is going to fall on the hitter side of things. You will win 0% of the games in which you don't score a run. But in the ninth, it was a rough one for Jordan Romano. He gives up a hit and then a two-run home run to Austin Wells. It's the second consecutive appearance in which he's given up runs. Joe Siddall of Sportsnet, of Blue Jays Central, joins us now. Joe, how are you this morning?
Very good, Blake. How are you doing?
I'm good, man. How concerned do you think the Toronto Blue Jays should be with Jordan Romano, whether it's the nail, whether it's just, hey, looks like he's hit a bit of a cold patch here late in the year, not just the last 2 days, but, six walks over his last 10 innings, six earned runs in that time. It hasn't been the sharpest of Septembers getting ready for the playoffs here for the Blue Jays closer.
Yeah, always a concern for sure. It doesn't matter who it is, but especially an impact player, a pitcher like Jordan at the back end. We talk so highly about this bullpen and all the weapons that they have down there, and it will be interesting to see in this final week where John Schneider and Pete Walker go with that. You know, I think best case scenario is Jordan can still get back out there and have one or two good outings and hopefully clinch this thing this week and go into the playoffs feeling good about yourself. Because if you can do that, these last several that we've seen didn't even happen, right? You just continue to move forward. It's like a new season. But until he does that, you have to feel a little bit concerned. I don't know about the finger. You know, we keep talking and hearing about this finger down. He pitched through it the other night. And then last night, I mean, watching him pitch, it doesn't look like there's a finger bothering him. It looked to me, I think John Schneider's quote was perfect. I mean, these Yankees hitters got a lot of these young guys. It's almost as though they're teaching that. Get the ball in the air. Get the ball in the air and elevate. And you don't want to be down to a Wells right there. And he left it down. How many times have we seen him dot 96, 98 up? He didn't have his top velocity when he first came in, but more importantly was the location down in the zone. And I didn't think he was out when he hit it. I knew he hit it good, but I didn't think he was going to go oppo out of the park. And it did, and it cost them. But I think in answer to your question, you're watching him closely this week, and more so than anything, rest is one thing, but you've got to get this guy's mindset right. And the way you do that is by getting them one or two good outings with a positive mindset going into the postseason, which we hope starts next week.
Yeah, we sure hope so. Dalton Varsho also didn't seem to think that one was out until the last second there, Joe. I'm curious. We can't know with the nail. We haven't seen it. You know, I'd imagine it. I don't even think we know which finger it's on. I'd imagine if it's the middle finger, that slider is really tough to kind of dig the top of your finger into. But there's something else that since Jordan Romano came back from the IL earlier in the year that I've picked up in the numbers a little bit. And I think Chris Black has raised this as well. Romano's getting a little less extension down the mound in his delivery. How could something like that affect Romano's effectiveness, whether it's location-wise or just how that fastball feels to a hitter coming out of his hand if he's not as far down the mound?
That was very interesting because that's a big factor, I'm sure. It's a big factor of why Jordan's so good when he can reach out like that and get down the mound the way he does. So anytime you have an injury as a pitcher, and I'm just speaking from a catcher now and watching guys on the mound, you're not necessarily with the naked eye going to see altering a delivery, but you can tell the way the baseball's entering your mitt. You can tell that if I'm catching Jordan time and time again, and I start catching him for a couple outings in a row, and it's not quite doesn't quite have that same pop or doesn't have that crispness on the slider, whatever the case may be. We've always said catching's the best seat in the house, right? Because not only are you receiving the pitch, but you're feeling it. You know what it has on it. And I know hitter swings tell us a lot of things. But as a catcher, you can be very intrigued to hear what they're saying. But a lot of those numbers that you're referring to and the metrics you're talking about, absolutely, those can have a huge impact. And I think Chris also mentioned something about his arm slot throughout the course of the season, whether it's higher up than it used to be or whatever the case may be. So those physical characteristics are one thing. But once those numbers start matching, and then, you know, like I said, I'm sure the catchers have had input too, because that all goes hand in hand. And if you're favoring something, or if you're even thinking, and when he came back from the back issue, if you're thinking about it for a couple of weeks, maybe you're not wanting to fully extend. That's just human nature, I think, coming back from an injury. So maybe there's a hurdle there still that he has to overcome.
You mentioned the catcher position. Let's stay there then. Alejandro Kirk with a hit yesterday, a really loud line out, maybe the best piece of contact the Blue Jays had all day. If we look at the second half of the year, his offensive numbers have come around a little bit. Over the last month, you know, his OPS is up around 800. He's walked more than he's struck out. I know at times with Kirk, you know, that plate discipline and that slow approach almost borders on being too passive. But right now it looks like he's found a little bit of a sweet spot here. Have you liked what you've seen from Alejandro Kirk at the plate, especially with the, you know, he's carrying a huge load for this team defensively as well. So maybe the offense is a little bit of gravy, but have you liked what he's doing at the plate the last little while?
Well, when Danny Jansen went down, we knew he was going to have to take on a bigger workload, and John Schneider said that. And that was a concern right away because we know how much they had protected him in the past. You know, rarely had he caught 4 days in a row behind the plate and all of that sort of stuff. So you had to wonder how that was going to play out. And by all measures so far, it seems to be pretty good. His swing is not the same as last year. Is it better lately? I mean, I thought his base hit last night in his first at bat was one of the better swings I've seen from him in a while, just because he stayed on the pitch so well. It was a fastball, I think it was middle, but he just stayed on it. And that's the Alejandro Kirk we know, right? When he really uses the middle of the field and stays on the pitch very well. And you know what I mean by that, by really focusing, it almost looks like he's really focusing center, right center. I think a lot of times this year when I've seen the issues we're seeing from him is he's getting pull happy and he's pulling off the baseball. Now, once again, for hitters, are you favoring something? Do you not feel that you can get to a good fastball? So you got to cheat a little bit. So you got to get out there and you start yanking things and pulling off it. Well, then that's going to leave you susceptible away. And I think we're going to continue to see pitchers try to go away on him. In middle in, he seems to cover much better. And I think teams will continue to do that because that bat right after that, he got like a slider down to the zone and he rolled it over to shortstop. So before that line drive that you referred to in the seventh. So there's certainly some inconsistencies there. And I think those inconsistencies are from his swing being different, because I think we'd agree that when he's at his best, and we've seen it last year as a Silver Slugger, he's pretty consistent with that approach and can handle all of those pitches.
Yeah, he can. And, you know, you'll take, this is one of those things where, you know, you'll take the improvement right now because you need it so badly and every at bat matters so much. But yeah, there is some work to be done in the off season as well to get back to that 2022 spot. I think, Joe, that's probably a fair way to frame what we're looking at with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. down the stretch here as well. Chris Black and I on the show yesterday broke down some of the process changes he's going through. Hey, he's not chasing a lot at all out of the zone until he gets the two strikes. We saw him yesterday go 3-0 and then may arguably get jobbed on two strikes there as well. The eye seems to be in the right spot. I know, Joe, that there has been a lot mechanically this year that Vlad, we're probably not going to be able to fully evaluate until, you know, we see what the swing looks like when he shows up next year. But in terms of changes he can make on the fly here and what we're looking for down the stretch. This recent hotter streak from Vlad, are you seeing some changes in the right direction with him at the plate?
Well, I think he's Vladdy, right? And this is why we all love to try to study him and figure him out so much, because he's so darn talented. And I think we would all agree on that one. I think with Vladdy, those were some tricky ABs last night. You're dealing with a really tough pitcher. I do think that, when you talk about reducing the chase and all, for example, well, I think he had a chase last night. I'm trying to remember the at bat, but he swung it. Maybe it was a changeup down. And I think he did it because he was selling out on a fastball. But to me, that's a good chase. Like that's what I want him to do against DeMichael King, because that's probably the only way you're going to hit that guy, is looking for a pitch and getting it. Now, you look for a pitch and don't get it, you're going to look silly and it's a chase. But to me, that's a good approach. So from what looked probably like a terrible swing, I would say, yes, that was great, actually. So it's funny when you crunch the numbers and look at that. But I think with anyone, we know it happened with Bo last year, right? When they get a little bit better control of the zone and don't chase as much and take their walks more, well, good hitters are swinging at better pitches. They're going to be really good. That happens for anybody, but especially for good hitters. I think with Vladdy, and we've gone back and forth this a million times this year already, is he where he was in 21? Absolutely not. Is he at a spot where he can certainly still help this team? Absolutely. There's no question. It's just the frustrating part is I'm just not seeing the swing mechanically that I know he's capable of, the swing that we have seen before. Is it coming back late September now? I don't think so. I don't think guys are going to do major altering changes to their swing right now. It's not going to happen. So you hope what he can do is what we saw maybe on the weekend, where you run into a couple. Do you sell out on a fastball here? Do you sit slider, guess right, and get the bat head out? I just think the angle is different of his bat angle coming through. The body's different. Everything's different. So is it good enough? Well, it can be good enough, but it's harder to do that. And we used that word inconsistent with Kirk earlier. Well, that's what it is with him. So he's so darn talented that he's still going to run into some. He's still going to get tons of hits because he hits the ball so hard even when his swing isn't right. So he just has all those things that he's still going to be good. Is it going to be good enough? Well, we sure would love to see the other Vladdy right now, because that could carry this team, because right now they need help everywhere they can get it. They're swinging the bat, scoring the runs at times here for the last little while, but I think we'd all agree, anytime they face a little bit of a tough starter, it's tough. I thought what King did to them last night, and that's what good pitchers do. We'll see it with Cole, I'm sure, tonight. Good pitchers have really good stuff, like those two guys, but what they also do is I think they really do a good job at attacking hitters' weaknesses. And what are they? Well, we saw what King did with Vladdy, right? Those sinkers away. I mean, you show in, but the sinkers away, change up down, and you ran a couple sinkers in on Bo early, and then you get him away with the breaking ball away. Stayed away from Springer. How many pop-ups do we see from Chapman and Varsho last night on elevated pitches, right? Like, they don't get to those pitches. And Kevin did the same thing, popped up a few times on pitches up in the zone. Like, these guys execute really, really well. And that's the tougher part about facing tough pitchers, because you're already battling the fact that they've got great stuff.
Well, at least it's only the probable AL Cy Young winner that they face tonight, right? Garrett Cole with a 0.46 ERA over three starts and 19 2/3 against the Blue Jays this year. Now, they saw him last week. They didn't have Brandon Belt available. I don't know if Brandon Belt's going to play every single game down the stretch here. I don't know if Brandon Belt is the particular matchup for Garrett Cole specifically. But when you look at this week ahead, the return of Brandon Belt to this lineup, Joe, what is front of mind for you when we're trying to see, hey, is Brandon Belt all the way back 100%? Is he ready to be an everyday piece in a wild card lineup? What is kind of front of mind for you? What are you looking for most from Belt these last five?
I mean, I want to see him drive some baseballs. We know he can take a walk, right? He just works the count like nobody else. He's such a good hitter in that regard. But I'd like to see some damage. I mean, he's probably going to hit a little bit higher. If he were to have a decent week this week, I'm guessing he'll probably hit fourth in a wild card game if they get there, and Kevin might drop a little bit. And, up in that spot, I mean, it's great that you can draw a walk here and there, but you got to see some damage. And to do that, he's going to have to get to, guess what, the elevated fastball, because that's where they're going. That's where King went last night. That's where Cole will probably go tonight. And that's where Tyler Glasnow will go if it's game one in Tampa, wherever they go. You can always say, and we've talked about different hitters with Nick Varsho and Chapman and David Schneider and trouble with those elevated pitches. And you can say lay off them, but a lot of them are in the strike zone. So you can't lay off all of them, because eventually you got to find a way to adjust your swing to hit it. But once again, it's late September. Are we going to see people adjust their swings right now to get to it? I've kind of lost hope on that part of it. So somehow, I mean, that's where I want to see him, because if this team is going to win in the playoffs, you need your four hitter doing some damage, not just drawing walks.
You certainly do. In terms of the lineup you mentioned there, if he's on, he's maybe in the four spot. We saw John Schneider separate the lefties a little bit yesterday, 4, 6, 7, 9, maybe Belton Biggio just flip there. But with that acknowledged that maybe Belton Biggio flip, is that what you think a wild card game one against a right-handed pitcher would look like, what we got last night?
I did. Yeah, I mentioned it to Caleb and Jamie on Blue Jay Central last night. I said, I think that could be your game one lineup. And the only reason I say that, I thought it spoke volumes that Kevin Biggio was at second base last night over Merrifield, because Michael King's a guy that's generally even tougher on lefties with that changeup and all, and Kevin was in there. Now, is it going to mean a whole lot different? Maybe not, but just the fact that that's what the lineup was, that's them telling me that they've got Kevin way over Witt right now. Now, it doesn't hurt to have Witt on the bench, and he can do some things off the bench, of course, if a lefty were to come in later. But, yeah, I think that spoke volumes, and I think as long as Brandon Belt has a good week this week and doesn't have any recurrences with that back, then I would think that's your lineup.
Joe, I guess, you know, obviously, look, if they clinch tomorrow, if they win tonight, win tomorrow, Seattle drops a game, whatever, they clinch it, and then the weekend lineups aren't going to tell us much of anything other than who wants to get some work in and who are they experimenting with. But if this thing goes down to the wire here and all of these games are urgent games and games you really have to put your best lineup out there for, how much do you think could change over the course of this week? I guess what I'm getting at is that, you know, there is obviously a value in role certainty and some stability in the lineup, but there's also an element of outside of your top four or five guys, maybe John Schneider has to play a hot hand a little bit. How much do you think could still change in terms of what a game one lineup looks like?
I think that second base position is the wild card right now, because everything else to me is fairly set. And the only reason I say that is I want Dalton Varsho in left field. In a playoff game, I mean, we're not going to have anything this year if they get to the playoffs where outfield defense is an issue. That's exactly what they patched up in the winter, and it's paid huge dividends for this team and for this pitching staff. So no way do you say, I want something else. It'd be easy if Witt was firing on all cylinders and hitting like he had been earlier this season, then that'd be a conversation. But I don't even think that's a conversation now. So I think Varsho's in left, and assuming Brandon Belt's healthy, he's DH. It's just that second base position, because Chapman's playing third. There's no question there, and your big guys are at the top. So I think that second base position, I mean, if Kevin goes 0 for 15 the rest of the week, then maybe Witt's going to get an opportunity, and maybe Witt has a couple good days towards the end. So that could factor in that final decision maybe for your second base spot. But either way, I'm neither here nor there with it, because if Biggio starts at second base, you've got those other guys on the bench. If they bring a lefty out of the pen, you've got maybe a Schneider if he's on the roster. You've got Witt for contact. And I like the Schneider option only because he's a threat. Despite all of his struggles, he could still be a threat in a playoff game with one big swing. And that's what I like about that. And if Witt were to start at second base, then you've got Kevin on the bench for a big reliever, you know, for Fairbanks or whoever the case may be. They have options. You know, this isn't the stellar type multi-million dollar bench like we've seen from other teams like the Dodgers in the past. But I think that second base position for me is the only one up in the air. And right now, as we speak, it's Kevin. And that's why I thought that lineup last night would be a playoff lineup.
And he looked good there again defensively. Obviously, he's improved a lot at first and third and right field. We haven't seen him a ton at second base, but he's looked pretty solid there as well. Joe, before I let you go here, it is the fourth time the Jays are going to see Gerrit Cole tonight. It's the second time in a couple weeks. Last time out, he was throwing a lot more breaking stuff than when we'd seen him last. A guy who's pitching at this level and has so many weapons he can go at you with, what is your strategy up there? Obviously, it's a little different player to player, but what are you looking for if you're going in there against Gerrit Cole?
Well, I've been trying to hit the fastball, but I think a lot of people have taken that to the plate, and it hasn't worked very well. It's tough. I mean, we know what these righties are going to get, and because I think I've heard so much about Garrett being such a student of the game, and I'm sure he is. He knows these Blue Jays hitters like the back of his hand, and he knows exactly how he wants to attack them. And trying to remember that last start. I mean, George, you're getting some curveballs and cutter and sliders down and away. Guess what? That's where they're going to be. You know, it's no secret. And Bo, I think he's going to go down there too. Like, I think the place to go is away from Bo, whether it's up and away, down and away, get out there. And that's what he does. He's so good. I just think that fastball I would love to stand in there against it because I just think it's even better than we think. And that's why, you know, I'm an analyst and I can say, geez, there's 97 right down the middle. You got to tee off on that. But we don't really know what that looks like in the batter's box, right? But I just don't think you can get caught trying to cover everything. You can't cover his breaking stuff away and the heater. So to me, you look for one and sell out on it. Much like I said with Vladdy last night against King. You guess wrong, and you look silly. But sometimes that's the only way to beat the good ones.
Yeah, hey, guessing wrong because you're sitting on something else. Well, that's your only chance of guessing right, too, right? You're not gonna cover all of it.
That's probably what playoff baseball is going to be, right? You're not going to get too many fourth or fifth starters in game one of the wild card series. So yeah. Get ready.
I don't think Ken Waldachuk is getting the ball for anyone or anything like that. Joe Siddle of Sports and of Blue Jay Central. You'll, of course, be on the Blue Jay Central desk all through this week and all through the playoffs. Thank you for taking the time this morning.
All right, Blake. Have a great day, man.
Joe Siddle, Blue Jay Central, alongside Jamie Campbell and Caleb Joseph this week, and of course, Blue Jay Central all through the playoffs. We'll see what the Jays end up with timing-wise. That'll be interesting just for me personally and my involvement on Blue Jay Central. Obviously, if the Jays land with Tampa as an opponent, we can make some assumptions about the time slot there versus if they land against the Central time zone opponent in Minnesota. Also, a weird possible situation here for Major League Baseball where it looks like Arizona's probably going to get in, but there's a scenario where no West Coast team is playing, let alone hosting in the wild card round. Good luck, schedule makers, keeping everyone happy there. We're going to keep you happy. We're going to take a break. When we come back, look at Eno Saris of The Athletic. We'll whip around both of the Cy Young races, take a little look at Gerrit Cole, see how Eno's feeling about these Blue Jays pitchers. Eno Saris joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Everything Raptors before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. The Jays will face the likely American League Cy Young winner tonight. Again, it'll be the fourth time they see Gerrit Cole this season. Over in the NL, I wonder. The race is wide open. Depending on how you sort those leaderboards, it could go a lot of different ways. Someone who knows an awful lot about all things pitching, and particularly those Cy Young races, is Eno Saris of The Athletic. Joined now by Eno Saris of The Athletic, the creator of Stuff Plus, the absolute beersman on the Major League Baseball beat. Eno, before we talk real baseball, though, got to ask, this is championship week. I know you're a big fantasy guy. We have the chance to finish 1-2 in our Roto League this year. How dialed in on are you on that specific outcome?
I really want to win that one because I don't actually know how many other ones I'm going to win this year. I've got a lot of second and third place finishes going for me right now. So I want to win that league.
Well, tell me about it, man. It looks like I'm going to finish second or third in that one. And yeah, it's going to be a season full of podiums without a banner for me. Sadly, it looks like overall, though, the year has mostly treated you well.
Just gold eluding me in a lot of places, but it was a weird year, honestly, to think about how much has changed this year. Just as a fan, if you're sitting in the seats, you probably noticed how different the game is this year. And just think back to March when we were trying to predict who would, you know, benefit the most and the least from these new rules. So it was a heavy lift this past offseason.
It certainly was. And I'll say this to make ourselves feel better a little bit, you know, fantasy baseball is like real baseball, where the true measure of quality is like the Dodgers are going to the playoffs for an 11th year in a row, which is almost impossible. Yeah, they only have one World Series, but 11 playoffs in a row is pretty good. It sounds like that's the kind of fantasy year you and I had.
Yeah. A lot of podiums. One gold, hopefully, maybe two.
Well, I'm rooting for you if I can't catch you. So on the professional side of baseball, and yeah, this is still professional, but it was a lot of fun. You got to do some interviews with your 11-year-old son recently. How was that experience for you as someone in the industry, but also just as someone who loves baseball the way you do and now gets to share that with your son?
Yeah, it's really funny. My 11-year-old has really caught the bug, and so he's now playing MLB The Show at home, collecting cards with me, constantly asking me who's good and who's not. So I gave him the opportunity to give me four questions to take into the clubhouse. And the players loved it. It was a, you know, especially a welcome respite in September from the are you guys collapsing? And it was around the San Francisco Giants too. So instead of asking them, are you guys boring? And why do the fans hate you? And things like that. I got to ask them stuff that just made them feel good about what it was like to be an 11-year-old baseball player, if they remembered that. And you know, if they remembered collecting cards and what their favorite animal was. Just silly questions not all silly. I mean, definitely relevant to my son, who is an 11-year-old baseball player who collects cards, you know. But he also got the opportunity to ask Blake Snell his four questions directly, and that was a big deal for him because he's a big Blake Snell fan. And Snell was just super gracious and funny. So there's a video out there on Twitter that you can see. He turns it back around and asks my son his favorite animal, and there's a pretty funny response.
Yeah, it's a good video. It was a lot of fun to see. So there's also a potential here where the one player that your son got to interview directly wins the National League Cy Young, and then we then say, well, yeah, any Cy Young candidate's going to want to be interviewed in September by your son to give him the bump. The NL Cy Young race it's pretty tight. It's pretty crazy. I think you can make a case for seven or eight guys. Hypothetical ballot, do you have Blake Snell at the top of yours right now?
I think so. I can comment on that one. I've got the AL Cy Young. I can't talk about that one. But, I think it's really tough to do this because if you think about anything other than like a strikeout and a walk and a homer, whether or not you think players have total control over balls in play or zero control over balls in play, there is some research, at different points in between. No matter what you think of that, every ball in play is a team out. It's a team collaboration. And so you can talk about, well, I only want to look at what results actually happen on the field. Well, all of those balls in play were team results, and you're trying to figure out an individual's value. It's a very difficult process because you can just start with just runs allowed. If you just look at runs allowed and then you don't even put errors into it because errors are a terrible stat, Blake Snell is number one in all of baseball and runs allowed wins over replacements. That's just runs allowed, made into like a sort of a quantity stat that you can compare people on. He's number one in the NL. Logan Webb is number two. Zach Allen's number three. If you say the pitcher has no control at all over balls in play and you reorder them, you get Zach Wheeler, Spencer Strider, and Zach Gallen, Logan Webb, and Blake Snell is all the way down at like sixth in the National League. So the truth is somewhere in between. And when I do my process, when I do it for the American League Cy Young, I'm going to combine a lot of these different approaches to find something in between. It won't be right because, it won't be exactly right, but there is no exactly right. When I try to kind of do that process for the NL, I think I come up with Blake Snell number one.
Well, that's justifiable, and it's going to be a fascinating ballot to look at because, again, like you just laid out, six or seven guys with a real good case, and the American League version of that is, hey, Kevin Gausman and Sonny Gray at the top of the list if we go by well, only what the pitcher can control. If we take a look at everything else, it's maybe Gerrit Cole. So I know you can't comment on the American League Cy Young race right now, Eno, but we're going to see Gerrit Cole Wednesday in Toronto for a second start in a row. When you look at his season as a whole, he's probably going to finish the year leading the American League in whip and innings pitched and maybe in ERA plus as well. For him to do this at age 33, when he's sustained this level for so long, what makes Gerrit Cole so special and capable of having, a 7-8 year run like this?
Well, one thing he's always done, it's kind of ironic this year, it's one of his lower strikeout years, but one thing he's always done is strike people out. If you look back 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, he's the leader in strikeouts, over any given time frame. So that's a good place to start. But he's got better command. He's not just, like a wild throwing guy. And he's just shown us such an ability to stay healthy. And those three things alone have made him, you know, worthy of any kind of praise you can put on him. This year, you know, I talked to him a bunch in spring training about his cutter. And, yeah, he's throwing it at a career high amount, but, you know, he's throwing it 7.5% of the time versus, you know, before he threw it 5%. So it's not like he really ramped it up. But one thing that cutter does, I think, is allow him to neutralize left-handers a little better and not give up the home runs. And the home runs have been the only sort of mark on Cole's career. This year he's suppressed the home runs using the cutter, and I think that'll be a model for him going forward as he starts to lose a little bit of elo, is to feature the secondaries more and use that cutter more often and still be an excellent pitcher all the way into, you know, his mid to late 30s.
Eno, want to pivot now and talk about some of the Jays starters, not from a Cy Young perspective, strictly from an analysis perspective. Kevin Gausman started on Tuesday. We're recording this ahead of this start, but he was going to face a team that's not very good, and that doesn't tell us very much about a data point that I was curious as to your take on. So when we look at pitcher splits in terms of who pitches the best against good teams, who pitches the best against worse teams, short of Taj Bradley, Kevin Gausman has the biggest split when we look at quality of competition. It's almost a three-run jump in ERA when he goes from bottom offenses to top offenses. Now, some of this is obviously good offenses are going to hit pitchers a little bit more. That's why they're good offenses. But this is the second most extreme gap in baseball. How much should something like that be on our radars heading into a postseason where you're probably not going to face many poor offenses?
You know, it is an interesting thing that I've heard coming out of Toronto is this idea that there may be some debate about who should start game one or whatever.
I think game one we're pretty set, but yeah, it's going to be Gausman in game one.
Okay, good. that's what I've been like, what? But I do get the idea that there are, you know, these four credible and five really credible starters that are all pretty good, and ordering them after Kevin Gausman may be somewhat interesting. But I also think that, you know, what this does for them as a team going into the playoffs is it allows them to use Kikuchi maybe as a fifth and sixth and seventh inning bridge, and maybe Ryu the same way, where you've got these lefties who can come in after righties. And, you know, one of the things that good lineups do is they have quality at every spot in the lineup. So, I mean, this is hypothetical and I guess would be the World Series. But if you were trying to match up against the Braves and you were like, man, Kevin Gausman has trouble against great offenses, and here's like one of the best offenses of all time, really, like they're about to break the record for home runs. I think they might have the record for OPS, too. So if you were thinking about that and you were worried about that, well, then you say, hey, like, Kevin, just go out there and throw your heart out. If it's four innings, it's four innings. We can put Ryu in for two innings, or Kikuchi in for two innings, and it's gonna take every single arm we've got to get through these games. And you're our best, so you know, even if it's only four or five, that's a way you can kind of maybe mitigate some of that, you know, because that's where you really get in trouble is you try to go into the sixth inning against a great offense. It's the third time you've seen Ronald Acuna Jr. and you're just like, you know, there's just a little bit of Acuna Sr. stuff and it takes you deep or whatever. So maybe avoid some of that. I think their deep rotation can be an asset in that way in the postseason.
Yeah, you would certainly hope so. And look, so Kevin Gausman's also a guy, you know, I know you saw him in San Fran when they made the playoffs in 2021. We saw him in the playoffs last, and hey, with that Giants team, he started and came out of the bullpen. So he was the guy doing that role change. When it comes to someone who is 32 years old, who has had a couple of good seasons, really good seasons at this point, when it's a more veteran guy like a Gausman, would you also subscribe to the belief that, hey, maybe there are some adjustments there that he just wasn't going to make during the regular season, and come playoff time, you know, if there is something underlying in that trend, maybe it's likelier that a guy will adjust in the postseason versus, you know, you maybe don't want to overreact start to start in the regular season?
I do think that some of these guys think about you know, the third time they'll see a team. Mm-hmm. I've definitely had a conversation with a pitcher where they've been like, oh, well, then maybe they'll see more of my curveball in September. You know what I mean? Like, oh, it's still in there, you know? So I do think that some of these veteran guys, you know, have some tricks that they leave in their bag that they will pull out in the postseason. But I also just think that at his core, Gausman is a two-pitch pitcher. And so if you look at these better lineups, or if you look at third time through the lineup or whatever it is, you will find that that two-pitch pitchers can have great strikeout rates, you know, and can perform well overall. But sometimes you'll see maybe an elevated home run rate or difficult third time through the order. Even someone like Spencer Strider, great two-pitch pitcher. Those two pitches are among the best pitches in baseball. He's had an elevated home run rate and given up a little bit more earned runs than you'd expect. I mean, that's the story with Kevin Gausman this year. 31% strikeout rate is amazing. 7% walk rate, really good. You know, if you look just at those two things, you would say he's the best pitcher in baseball. So, you know, then you can just look no further than Chris Bassett, who's standing right next to him, that has no pitch that's anywhere close to the quality of Kevin Gausman's fastball or changeup. And he just has 8 pitches. And he's like, dude, I got 8 pitches, and you just don't know which one's coming. And Bassett's had his own value for the team in just a completely opposite way.
So when we look at the Blue Jays rotation, I know you kind of just teed it up that you can mix and match. You can have guys come out of the bullpen. But you do have 4, arguably 5 with Ryu, pretty good pitchers. And you're not going to use all of them as starters in a postseason. This is a mailbag question you answered recently at The Athletic, Eno. So this can be about the Blue Jays or just generally. If you are a team like that where the rotation goes 4 deep, 5 deep, I think of a team like the Twins that's obviously top 2 heavy but has a question mark as to who gets the nod as the third person in there. What kind of things are you looking for when you set up your wild card rotation when you're picking, you know, 3 out of 4 or 5 potentially decent candidates? This applies to the Orioles as well, another team that I think we know who they'd want 1 and 2, but number 3 is kind of anyone's guess.
Yeah, I think one thing that's underrated is in the age of kind of bullpen games and starters not going very deep, you have to look at your schedule and think about rest days and think about your bullpen. And so I think you just put Gausman in the first one and you do whatever it takes to win that game. I think what you want to do is put the guy in the second spot that you think has the chance to go the deepest. You know, and the reason I say that is you want as many arms rested for the final day as you can. You really don't want to use Romano, for example, 3 days straight. Relievers are so much worse if you use them 3 days straight than they are if you just use them back to back. So if you can throw somebody that could theoretically go deeper into the game, you know, and I think, you know, Chris Bassett might be that guy in terms of if you look at innings pitch per appearance or per start. You know, he looks like a good number 2 because you'd hopefully get him in there longer and save more arms for the third. You know, and Kikuchi, and then I think also, you know, you think about things like command and breadth of arsenal. You know, Kikuchi to me is somebody that with that touch and go command, sometimes he's not somebody I would start in the game 2 because, you know, just theoretically because. You know, what if he goes 2 or 3 and now you're just emptying out your bullpen in game 2? And what if you then lose that game and you have to go back to game 3 and you used all your best relievers the night before? So there's these things about, you might even think about park factors. You might think about lineups, but I think you also have to think about bullpens and rest and depth when you start lining people up.
Yeah, and hey, look, you're in a much, much better position if you win game 1, right? You're in control. If you lose game 1, you got to play game 2 like you just described game 3 anyway, just to live another day. You know, elsewhere in this American League wild card picture, the Twins can start Pablo Lopez and Sonny Gray 1-2 in a wild card series, or 1-3 if they prefer. When you look at that team, obviously the Twins on record and coming out of the AL Central, they look on paper like probably the weakest team that'll make the American League playoff picture. Again, they're at 83 wins right now. They're coming out of the Central, so that's a little inflated. But having those two guys
at the top of your rotation. How much more dangerous does a team like the Twins become when they can lean on Lopez and Gray a little more regularly and drop some of the, you know, fifth, even fourth starter at time from the mix?
I think that will make them more dangerous. One of the questions for me is just how good that offense is. Mm-hmm. For the year, Minnesota is 11th in WAR, but 8th in, you know, WRC plus, which is just like OPS plus. Mm-hmm. So they're 8th in park adjusted offense. But it looks a little better, if I remember correctly, over the last 30 days. Yeah. Look, they're up to 5th. And so they're steadily climbing. The one thing that I do think of when I think of the Twins offense, and this has been true for like 4 or 5 years, so I believe this is the Twins way, if there's a capital T to capital W. I believe that they are a team that tries to elevate the ball, hit the ball in the air for home runs. They have one of the largest launch angles over the history of StatCast, and they also have one of the higher strikeout rates over the history of StatCast. So it'll be a series that's decided on homers, whether or not the Blue Jays can exploit that strikeout rate and avoid the homers, or if they get enough homers to outpace their strikeout rate. But it is a team that can be pitched to, which is evidenced by their strikeout rate.
You know, over in the National League wildcard picture, the Philadelphia Phillies got a boost the other day, and I don't know if they're going to use them. I don't know how much they're going to trust them, but they have a 22-year-old in Orion Kirkering, who went single A to high A to double A to triple A and now to the majors all in one season. Just how nasty of a slider are we talking about with Orion?
Immediately top five by Stuff Plus. And was one of those things where even as he's breaking it out in the game, everyone was kind of tweeting out pictures of it and super excited. And one thing that is really interesting about doing this is I remember when Francisco Rodriguez was a young pitcher for the Angels, and they brought him up, just in time for the playoffs, and he just blew through the playoffs, partially because nobody had seen him at all. And there is proof that, like, the more you see a pitcher's shapes in a game, the better you can hit them. And I believe that makes sense, that the more you see them over the whole course of their careers, the better you can hit them. And so to have a guy who comes up here throwing an 88-mile-an-hour slider with that much movement, and they haven't seen it before, and then he also, he throws 100, is such a wonderful thing to be able to turn to, especially because their back end of their bullpen's pretty good, but games get decided in the sixth inning so often. And just to have a sort of secret weapon that you can break out in the sixth before you get to Kimbrel and Sir Anthony Dominguez and Soto and Alvarado just makes that bullpen so nasty. And so, you know, maybe they don't have the best rotation in baseball, but they do have a pretty good number one and number two, and they have one of the better bullpens in baseball. And if that lineup can gel, I mean, they could get back to the World Series, even though, you know, when you look at the standings, you say, well, you know, 87, 90 wins for the season. You know, that's a good but not great team. The Braves are going to run all through them. Well, the Phillies have held their own against the Braves during the season, and we may see the Phillies back in the World Series.
Yeah, Jeff Hoffman, a part of that bullpen as well, former Jays prospect, who they actually just pitched three days in a row.
He's really found it.
Yeah.
He's really found it with them. He's different now. He's got a new slider. And he's a reliever now, but that's a real redemption story for him.
You know, this is a bit of a look ahead, but I doubt I'll talk to you again before free agency. So quickly here, Shota Imanaga and Yoshinobu Yamamoto. How well, based on your data and your projections, do those guys figure to translate to Major League Baseball if they come over as free agents and posting options this offseason?
I think with Kodai Senga's success, you can kind of compare both of them to Kodai Senga and get an idea of how they'll translate. Yamamoto is a little bit like a Senga with better command. And then Imanaga actually had superior strikeout and walk and stuff plus numbers, which I got from the WBC, to Yamamoto. But he's older. Sure, if that matters, and so he may get a lesser deal than Yamamoto. There seems to be Less excitement about Imanaga, but if my team ends up with Imanaga for less money than Yamamoto, I'd be pretty excited. I think that he's got something going on. He's like a shorter guy with the high riding fastball, and there's been a real demand for that. It's the kind of release point that makes Strider's fastball so good. This kind of lower release point with ride has shown to be really effective in baseball these days. So I think if I was given the choice, I mean, I guess Yamamoto is better, but given what I think the contracts will look like, I'm taking Imanaga.
This bias against 5'10" men has gone too far. You know, we gotta have one in the mix.
We flipped it.
Yeah,
it's flipped now. We got a bias for it now.
Yeah,
I actually talked to Kyle Quantrill recently, and he said, you know, I wish I could be shorter and have a higher release point, but that's not me. And I was like, wow, that's surprising.
Before I let you go here, there was a terrific piece on you on Good Beer Hunting this week. A lot of very nice things said about you, very well deserved. How odd was it for you to be the subject of an article instead of the author of an article?
Oh, man, super weird. I mean, you as a writer, you want to control the narrative. I mean, that's your craft. And so just knowing that, and it was okay because I know Brian Roth, and he's also into stats and beer and baseball. So I was like, you know, he's not going to screw this one up probably. But I was very nervous about that being in the world, knowing he was calling people from my high school that, you know, and I had no control over it. I was very nervous.
Stats, beer, and baseball. What else even is there? You know, I guess family, now that your son is in the mix on the baseball side as well, but not much more to it than that. Thanks so much for taking the time out this morning. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me.
Eno Saris of The Athletic.
Great chat there. Always fun to pick Eno's brain about all things pitching. Gerrit Cole on the Hill tonight. Eno did not tip his hand there, but I would imagine he is at the top of a lot of Cy Young ballots, both hypothetical and real. If you go by Fangraphs wins above replacement, which as a refresher takes away some of the blame for pitchers on what happens when a ball is in play. It primarily comes down to strikeouts, walks, and home runs, which are the three things a pitcher is most in control of. By that sort, you could go with one of the Twins guys. You could go with Kevin Gausman. You could go with Gerrit Cole. You could go a couple different ways there. If you use Baseball Reference's version of wins above replacement, which is more about what actually happened, it's not particularly close. Gerrit Cole is well ahead of the pack there. Now, I would advocate you don't use either wins above replacement sort filter as the way to make your vote. We obviously have to look at a lot of context here. We have to look at team defense context. We have to look at all sorts of context, but I think no matter how you chop it up, Gerrit Cole is going to come out looking pretty good. If you're old school, he leads the league in win percentage. He also leads the league in games started, in ERA, in innings pitched, in ERA plus, in whip, in hits per nine, pretty much anything you'd want to lead the league in, except for strikeouts, oddly enough, because Kevin Gausman is going to beat him unless Gerrit Cole strikes out, I don't know, like 27 guys tonight or something like that. Wouldn't put it past him, but probably unlikely. You've seen a lot of him this year. You've seen him recently. But as a refresher, the Jays lefties in the lineups are going to see that fastball a little more than 50% of the time. He'll mix in a slider and a curve. He'll sprinkle in a changeup and a cutter, but he doesn't use those a ton. Against righties, again, about 50% fastball. Then you're going slider, curve, and a bit more of the cutter to righties than to lefties. As the season's gone on, though, he has used the breaking stuff more often. Against the Jays last time out, it was actually 55% breaking stuff that the Jays saw, rather than, you know, usually it's the fastball that's closer to the 55%. So that'll be something to monitor, whether that is something Gerrit Cole did unique to the Blue Jays, whether that's something Gerrit Cole has just done as the season's gone on. Either way, he's in pretty good shape for the Cy Young. He'll try to make his closing argument tonight. On the other side, the Jays will start Jose Berríos, friend of the show, guest of the show. He has been really solid. If we obviously don't do this, but if we take away those first two starts of the season where he was quite rough, rough World Baseball Classic outing as well, he's a 3.16 ERA since then. The Jays are also 17-12 in his 29 starts, so pretty good record there, like was the case last year. Now, he has had a bit of trouble with lefties for parts of this season, similar to Chris Bassitt, as a righty who doesn't have top end stuff, you're going to be prone to some platoon splits if your stuff isn't particularly on, if a team game plans for you well. But over his last couple starts, Berríos has ironed out some of those righty versus lefty issues. That's probably front of mind for me today in Berríos' last start of the regular season. Although, again, if the Yankees lineup is anything like what it looked like yesterday or last series, and it will be because they just don't have the horses right now. I don't know that you're going to draw too many conclusions from tonight's game. What you can draw is one, maybe even two games closer to clinching a wild card spot, depending on what happens in that Mariners-Astros game. So big stakes when Jose Berríos takes the hill against Gerrit Cole tonight. Thank you to Ben Nicholson-Smith for coming on earlier, to John Morosi, to Joe Siddle, and to Eno Saras. Thank you to Nick, Lance, and Jennifer behind the glass as well. Blair and Barker have you 5 to 7, and Jays Talk postgame as usual. Jesse Rubinoff, Show Ali with you next.